everyone, this is Neil Rockine. Welcome to another episode of Killer Cross-Examination. You'll notice the podcast is called Killer Cross-Examination by Neil Rockine, the Rockweiler. That's my nickname. And I got that nickname because I've been considered a very aggressive courtroom lawyer. And I know that I'm not alone. There are other lawyers out there who are tremendous, awesome, amazing criminal defense lawyers and civil trial lawyers. And I've been blessed to be able to interview them and talk to them. And these are peers and other lawyers that have really sort of been battle tested. And no one, in my opinion, has been more battle tested perhaps in the last 10, 15 years than my good friend, Yale Galanter. Yale, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Neil.
So I want to kind of get right to it because your office is, I know you're a criminal defense lawyer, but do you do civil litigation as well? Is that right?
We do complex civil litigation. We don't do the standard PI business dispute, but if something is new and unusual, we'll take it on. As a matter of fact, I don't know if we're going to get to this, but one of the greatest, I think, accomplishments of my career was doing a civil case that was out of the box for me as a criminal defense lawyer.
So I want to put a pin in that, or pin that to the wall here for 1 second, because obviously you didn't just walk into the law practice and open up your doors and all of a sudden find that you had a line of people that were demanding your services. Somehow you got to this point. So walk us through a little bit about, you know, how you started your career, what made you attracted to litigation and criminal defense, and how you've kind of become one of the more sought after lawyers in the country, in my opinion.
Well, thanks for those kind words. Yeah, but truthfully, I mean, I really fell into it. I grew up in a liberal Jewish Northeastern Cherry Hill, New Jersey family. My father was an optometrist. My mother was a homemaker. My parents originally wanted me to be a professional golfer, which was very unusual because all of my other, Jewish elementary school, junior school and high school friends were like, they don't want you to be a doctor or a lawyer. And I said, no. And I was a country club brat, very blessed to have the kind of relationship and childhood I did with my parents. My father wanted me to go into his practice. I did not like medicine at all. Just the thought of blood and science was just, not for me. One day I said to my dad when I was either 17 or 18, Dad, I want to go to Hollywood and be an actor. And my father, being my mentor, best friend, and one of the smartest people I never knew, said to me, Yale, I'll make a deal with you. Why don't you either go to medical school or law school? And after, I'll be more than happy to fund you in Hollywood and see what happens. And of course, he probably knew that if I found something that I really had a passion for, that I would give up the acting career. I chose law school, went to Nova in Fort Lauderdale, was there for 3 years and absolutely positively loved it. Went to work immediately for the state attorney's office in Broward County, then went to work for the state attorney's office in Dade County. And when I was getting ready to leave the state attorney's office, I was offered a job as a commentator on court TV and started doing TV analysis. And, as they say, the rest is history. I ended up opening a criminal defense law firm. And over 35 years later, here we are. I'm still practicing.
All right, we're back with Yale Galanter. And Yale, I think we left off talking with you about how it was that you got from the beginning of your career to the point where you're one of the most sought after lawyers in the country. And I think I had sort of alluded to the fact that it doesn't happen overnight. Maybe in your case it did, but I would love to hear how you got from point A to really point M or N, wherever you are on that career scale.
Sure. So when I... as I was telling you, my parents did not want me to be a doctor or a lawyer, which was very unusual for a liberal Cherry Hill Jewish family. I ended up going to undergraduate school at the University of Miami, went to law school at Nova. And my first job out of law school was working at the Broward State Attorney's Office, and then eventually at the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office. When I left, I was a combination of both prosecutor's offices for 5 years. When I left, quite frankly, I met a girl. And the girl comes up to me in the hallway at the Metro Justice Building one day and says, you know, Yale, we'd love to interview you and have you audition for to become one of our legal analysts on Court TV. And I, of course, said, what's Court TV? And I was single at the time, and she was a female, and I thought this was great, right? I mean, I got this offer to go to New York, and I'm going to audition for Court TV and, you know, everything else. And I ended up becoming one of the go-to legal analysts for Court TV, you know, in the early days of Court TV. And that's really, in my opinion, what propelled everything, you know, just having that national exposure. I was very fortunate to work with someone by the name of Catherine Cryer, who had an anchor show at 4 and 6 on Court TV.
Called the Cryer Report, I think. Is that what her show was called?
Yeah, I think it was the Cryer Report. But, you know, Catherine was a former judge from Texas, and she really was my idol. I mean, she was fabulous. She was just a great commentator, journalist, lawyer. You know, she just really got right to the heart of all the legal issues. It was one of those legal shows that I absolutely adored doing because got right to the heart of all of the issues without any political BS. You know, she so would always have.
I do legal analysis for the NBC affiliate here in Detroit.
Uh-huh.
One of the things that I try to do is I try to call it straight. So, I mean, if the issue is something that runs contrary to my, you know, my practice, for example, I think that the guy looks guilty or awful or the case is being presented well, I say that. If there's an injustice happening, I try to point that out. I know some analysts don't do that. They sort of use it as a platform to really kind of promote their perspective. How did you do that as an analyst, as an expert for Court TV?
I'll tell you, if a word came out of my mouth, it was 100% truthful. There was no spin. I didn't care if somebody called me or didn't call me. I called it just the way it was. And there were a number of times that I was on the air and one of my producers would be, you know, saying to me, my IFB, Gail, don't go there. Don't go there. And I went there. I mean, I just, you know, I really did. I always, you know, I called it the way it was. In the very beginning of my legal analysis career, I was probably not as good as I wanted to be. You know, my father, when I would get off the air, I would call my father all the time, who was a doctor. And I would say to him, what'd you think? And he would really mentor me and say, you know, Yale, you know, you're developing this great power. You know, you have a TV camera, a microphone, you know, you can tell the same story and always take the high road. And it took me a couple of years to get there, to learn how to criticize what I saw other lawyers doing, but take the high road and kind of walk in their shoes and realize how difficult it is to be under the media spotlight. Because remember, at that time, I hadn't had any big media cases myself. So it was, you know.
Give me an example of what we'll talk. I know you ultimately had some of the biggest media cases with some of the highest, you know, most intense coverage in several different cases. But tell me what you mean taking the high road.
Well, I think when you're on TV and guys like you and I who are lawyers and were asked to really critique other lawyers, you know, there are ways to do it. As my grandmother used to say, you could do it with a pound of vinegar or a pound of honey. And, you know, when I first started doing analysis for Court TV, I was probably I was definitely rough around the edges. But just to give you an example,
you were doing it live, right? They were live.
Yeah, it was all live. Just to give you an example, if I saw a lawyer fumble on a cross-examination, I would say, you know, so-and-so really dropped the ball there, as opposed to saying, you know, Catherine, having been in that situation hundreds of times myself, I know how difficult this could be. You know, Mr. So-and-so could come back on recross and regroup and then hit the nail on the head. So, you know, it's all in delivery, right? That's what we need to learn as lawyers. I mean, the difference between good and bad lawyers isn't only, you know, having the smarts, having the preparation, but know how to do the delivery. So, and I tell that to law students all the time, you know, there are 100 ways to deliver the message. You got to figure out the most effective way to do it. And people enjoy hearing a lot of good, but not a lot of bad. I mean, they really do. You know, like right now we're in this, we've got this political divide in the country, and you've got the, you know, the people on CNN attacking the people on Fox. Well, Court TV, we never did that. I mean, we called it the way we saw it, but we never tried to really slit anybody's throat or do any bloodletting. And as you know, there's a lot of bad lawyering out there. And when you're doing analysis, you've got to bring up what is wrong with the case or how you think the case is either failing or going well, but you got to deliver the message in such a way that that it's not too critical. And it you know, you kind of, I use this term, you got to take the high road, which is what we tried to do. I mean, all the analysts at Court TV tried to do it. But remember, you know, when I started in Court TV, it was a young network. We were, even the network was inexperienced. We were all inexperienced doing that. I think it's come a long way.
Did you, when you were with Court TV, did you ever work with Johnny Cochran?
Yeah.
What was that like?
You know, Johnny, may he rest in peace, was just one of those brilliant, brilliant lawyers, very passionate about his clients, very passionate about the statements that came out of his mouth. He was, you know, one of these lawyers who was really dedicated to helping the downtrodden and, you know, doing good for society and his community.
Did you know who he was before you started at Court TV, or did you get acquainted with him during that process?
No, it was after I started at Court TV. I mean, I was basically, I'll tell you a real funny story. When I first got on Court TV, there was
You guys are using tin cans and a string.
There was a local, I was practicing in Miami-Dade County, and there was a reporter for Court TV by the name of Beth Karras. And one of the first things she ever said about me was, you know, we're going to have Yale Galanter on the air. He's a local lawyer from Miami. And now, of course, Beth and I mean, I haven't spoken to her in a while since the pandemic. I consider Beth to be very close with my wife and I, a really great friend, great reporter, but we laugh about that now. So yeah, prior to Court TV, local lawyer from Miami. After Court TV, right, things totally changed.
Powerhouse, right.
Right, things totally changed for me. Totally.
So did you ever work with Nancy Grace?
Oh yeah, worked with Nancy a lot.
So what did you think? What was your take on, and is she the person behind the scenes and personally as she is on the air?
Listen, so having been on air and done Nancy's program numerous times, the on-air Nancy and the off-air Nancy are two completely different people.
Interesting.
She's got an on-air, very sharp persona. Off the air, she is an absolute sweetheart. And to this day, I would do anything for her. And we've done battle, you know, on her program a number of times, where, you know, obviously she was not too fond to some of my clients and I would have to defend them. But off the air, you know, I still consider Nancy a friend, would invite her to my home for dinner. And if she ever needed anything, I'd be there in a heartbeat for her. I mean, she really is. She's a sweetheart. She's had.
I'm one of the things that I picked up from our. So when you first started on Court TV, you said you were sort of, you know, like the, you know, the young prosecutors and young lawyers, particularly young prosecutors, because I was one of those once. And, you know, we just wanted just throw us the red meat. I mean, we just wanted to battle.
Yep.
And Was that your style as a lawyer, or was your style more refined? How would you characterize sort of your progression from beginning of your trial lawyer days up until even now?
Well, exactly what you said. I mean, you know, you're a young lawyer, you graduate from law school, you start at the state attorney's office, they give you a pile of cases, and what do you mean urinating in public? Of course you got to go to prison for 10 years. It's a whole different mantra. And, you know, I think good lawyers mature well. And what I mean by that is if you've got it in you to be a good litigator, whether you're a prosecutor or a criminal defense lawyer, doesn't matter. When you mature well, you get my father's favorite saying was, you know, Yale, you're rough around the edges. We got to polish them. And, you know, law school doesn't teach you how to do that. You know, it doesn't teach you how to deliver the message. It doesn't teach you how to speak eloquently and professionally to a judge, even when you know a judge is wrong, but still deliver the message in a very respectful
and doesn't teach you that at all. It teaches you how to try to distinguish between two cases from two different centuries. And, you know, the reality is that the true answer is the court changed, then the justice has changed, but they had to figure out a way to go from, you know, A to B.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it takes a while for lawyers to get there. And I was certainly no different.
What was your first trial? What was the first trial that you can think back of and say, boy, as the analyst that you've been, and you were to analyze yourself, what was the first trial, and what would you think of yourself if you saw that Yale Galanter today?
So I don't actually remember the exact first trial, but I do remember the first time as a prosecutor, I tried a case, I lost the case, and the judge called me into chambers, who ended up being a mentor of mine, and just ripped me a new one. I mean, it was, you know, I'll never forget that conversation till the day I die. And, you know, he was basically saying to me, you know, as a prosecutor, your job is not to put people in jail. You know, it's not to go after every case. It's to, do you have the evidence? Can you prove it beyond the exclusion of a reasonable doubt? Is this the type of person that you really do want to incarcerate? Or is this the type of person who just needs a little help in life, you know, a little rehabilitation, maybe a program, you know? So the judge was named, it may rest in peace, his name was Fred Nesbitt. And he basically said to me, you know, as a prosecutor, you have great power, you know, have empathy. And even today, when I walk into courtrooms and I'm facing young prosecutors, you know, I'll say to them, you remind me of me when I was your age, you know, like on a possession marijuana case, they're talking to me about, you know, tons of community service and programs and yada, yada, yada. And it just, it took a while.
When you walk in, they know you, I presume. They know who you are, or, I mean, they know you. So when you walk in, Yale, do you think that they're gearing up for the, I'm battling Yale Galanter and I want to get one over on them? Or do you see them as more deferential and respectful? Or maybe it's just a grab bag and you don't know.
Well, so listen, Neil, it's hard for me to speak for an adversary. And, you know, you'd probably be better off interviewing one of those prosecutors, and I could certainly give you a list of them, but I'll tell you what my impression is. Like all lawyers, you know, today with Google and social media, you know, like I have no secrets in my life. You know, you Google me and go back to when I was 16 years old, if you go back far enough. So I think people get a certain impression of who you are and what you are. And I think those impressions based on what they read and see in social media are wrong. So one of the first things I do is I try and tone it down immediately. You know, tell a war story. You know, talk to a prosecutor like when I was a prosecutor about a case. And I think that just goes with the territory of having a high profile career. It's just one of the things you got to deal with. And the other thing is, once you get into a case and you establish credibility with a prosecutor and or a judge, I think all of those myths or perceptions fall by the wayside. But yes, I'm definitely cognizant of that. Whenever I take on a new case that I think is going to have some media aspect to it, because listen, the most important thing we have as lawyers is our credibility. So if I say something to a prosecutor, I say something to a judge, I want them to know they could take it to the bank. I don't want them to have to double check or doubt my word. And the only way you do that is by always establishing credibility. And just while we're at it, to the young lawyers who are listening to your podcast, I mean, that's the major thing. I mean, if you walk into court and you're not sure of a fact, don't let it come out of your mouth. You know, you can't BS your way out of a case in a courtroom because there are just too many eyes looking upon you. And when you're wrong about something, admit it. If you don't have the case law, it's not on your side, admit it. You have no idea how much respect and credibility you get when you do those things. So yes, I'm cognizant of it. Yes, I'm very aware of it. Sometimes it's worse than others, but you know, normally after a month or two, I can make it work to my advantage.
So I know that there came a point in time when you began to be sought after, and you probably still are to this day, but where some high profile celebrity type, you know, we'll just call celebrities, I mean, people that are in the news, high profile, when they sought out your representation. The ones that I know about just from that, I think the public would know about, of course, are, I know at one point you represented Charlie Sheen. I think at one point you represented Brooke Mueller, I think, who was involved with Charlie Sheen, I think. And then obviously at one point, I know you represented O.J. Simpson, multiple cases involving O.J. Simpson.
Right.
So how did you get to a point? How did you get to a point where when those sorts of clients called, did you put them on hold and go like, wow, this is awesome? Or did you just, you know, I mean, tell me how you sort of got into that role of being the lawyer for the high profile client.
Well, it depends on who the client was, but let's talk about probably the most infamous client for a second, which was O.J. Simpson. So O.J. Simpson was referred to my law firm by another civil firm in Miami. He had moved to Miami. He had been there probably less than a year and he got involved in a road rage incident.
And this is post acquittal in California.
Right. The acquittal was in 95, 96. This is in 2000, 2001. And I had met him before that because I was doing some work in L.A., but that's another story. But, you know, I come to my office one day and one of my office managers is in the parking lot and she's never in the parking lot. And she greets me and she hugs me and she whispers in my ear and she says, "Gail, O.J. Simpson's in our conference room." And I looked at her and I said, "A, why are you whispering? Why are you hugging me? We're the only two people here in the parking lot." And then, you know, it took her a while to realize this, but it was such a shocking event for my office staff and the lawyers that worked for me that this was occurring. And I think Allie at the time, was it Allie or Jackie? I don't remember whether it was Allie or Jackie, but they wanted to give me a heads up on what was going on. And I had, of course, read about the road rage incident, so I knew why he was there. And, you know, went into the office, did some, you know, phone calls, whatever I had to do, grabbed a scotch, but I didn't. I grabbed a cup of coffee. And I met him in the conference room and, you know, interviewed him and went through, you know, with him the road rage case. And, you know, when he left the office, I was in shock. I mean, I was absolutely positively in shock.
Now you tried that case.
Yeah, I tried the case. Yep, tried the case.
Jury trial.
Jury trial. Yep, me against Abby Rifkin and Paul Mendelson. Paul has since passed away. Abby, I believe, is still at the Dade State Attorney's Office. She's trying to become a judge. Great, great, great lawyer. Paul was a fabulous lawyer. We were in front of a judge by the name of Dennis Murphy, who had just gotten on the bench. I don't remember exactly, but maybe less than a year. He was fabulous. You know, it was one of those cases that really set Miami on its ear in terms of the media presence, you know, security at the courthouse. It was, you know,
was that case televised live? Yeah. Were there cameras in the courtroom?
There were cameras in the courtroom.
So this is a great segue for me to ask you. So I know, and every lawyer has their own style. In terms of walking into the courtroom with O.J. Simpson, I mean, he was obviously super famous before the case in Los Angeles. And of course, at that point, he was super famous, infamous, well-known, whatever you want to call it. Did you get to pick a jury? Did you get to conduct voir dire yourself? And how did you, if you did, how did you address the fact that this was O.J. Simpson, who the jurors, I'm sure, all knew and were aware of?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously, when you're representing someone like O.J., who brought the baggage into the courtroom that he brought in, you know, you had to deal with it. But and I did. I mean, I said to the jurors, you know, how did you feel about the verdict, you know, the murder verdict, for it, against it? And I said to all of them, you know, could you, whatever your personal feelings are, could you put that aside and just judge this case on this particular case? And at that time, the country was pretty divided. Half of the country was thrilled with the verdict, and the other half of the country was not thrilled with the verdict. So we didn't have that universal dislike that he probably has now. And there were a lot of things that contributed to that. But once we got over that, I just tried the case like it was a normal road rage case.
So when you were questioning the jurors, do you have a particular approach? I've seen some lawyers that are really skilled, I mean, really well-known lawyers, who really don't do well during jury selection for whatever reason. They just are, I don't know if they're afraid to get a bad answer or get a wrong answer, or they're afraid some juror's gonna, you know, say something. I sort of have the opposite view. I want jurors to tell me what's on their mind and be totally open. How did you approach that with OJ? And when a juror said, for example, yeah, I knew about the trial, did you follow up with any questions specifically to them? And
okay, so you what you're really asking me is, yeah, what's your general approach to voir dire? And it's really not specific to OJ's case or Charlie's case or any of the other celebrities' cases that my firm has been blessed to do. I think there are two things that lawyers have to do. One is they got to be themselves. That is, Neil, I cannot tell you how, you know, lawyers that walk into court with, you know, $1,000 Armani suits and cowboy boots and Rolex watches and, you know, gold pinky rings, don't work. I mean, it just does not work.
You don't think we're all supposed to go to a trial lawyer school and try to be the guy who's teaching the trial lawyer school, whether it's in Wyoming or Texas or New York or California or Florida? Because I've seen people do that.
I make this a practice. I walk into court with my Casio watch, my penny loafers, my Brooks Brothers suits, and it's always navy, white shirt, maroon tie, or some variation of that. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you've got to talk to jurors as if you're one of them. And you really are one of them. I mean, when I'm trying a case in Miami, I mean, I've lived in Miami since I'm 17 years old. I mean, these are my, this is part of my community. I can relate to these people. You know, when I picked the jury in the road rage case, after I got over the murder baggage issues, you know, I said to the jurors, you know, do you pick your kids up after school? Do you drop them off? Do you drive them home? What would you do if you thought somebody was following you? You know, that's what's going through my mind. I'm thinking to myself, I want to get a juror who's been in OJ's position. I want to get someone because that's what that case
is. You want them to have a mental image of themselves in that moment so that they can can relate. Some people call it like an emotional congruence or whatever, but you want them to be able to, when the case comes out, feel what you're trying to describe OJ was feeling.
Right. So there are two things. Again, you want to, you know, be part of their community, and you are part of their community. You need to be totally honest, and you need to give them, and, you know, again, depending on who the judge is, on how far you could go with this, you want to give them some preview of what's going to occur in the case and try to figure out, you know, how they feel about this. And, you know, in that case, when I was describing the facts of the case and what they were going to hear and if they had any problems with them, I wasn't so much concerned with their answers. I was concerned with their reaction. To give you an example, would you be protective of your children? So if somebody would look at me like, I didn't even need to hear what came out of their mouth. That's the type of juror I was looking for, because that's what, you know, when you get a case, you got to analyze it and break it down to its simplest common denominator. So in this case, it was OJ had picked up his minor children from school, was driving home. Somebody was following him. OJ was concerned about the safety and welfare of his children. You wanted to get jurors who could either empathize or picture themselves in that position. So, and, you know, we picked that jury and, you know, my team and I knew we were going to win the case. It was just no shot because there was, you know, first of all, I don't think OJ did anything wrong. I don't think he should have ever been arrested. So it's always good to have that kind of a factual pattern to start. But number two, I mean, somebody's following you, taking pictures of you and your kids, and then they touch your bumper. I mean, who wouldn't get out and defend their, you know, the safety of their children? I mean, it's just a natural parental instinct, and that's the type of juror you want. That's what you want to build on.
How long did that trial last?
Oh, I don't remember, but it was long. I think it was 2.5 weeks total.
Seems like a long time for that case. To the state, sometimes I've seen the state over try a high profile case. And I'm not saying that happened there, but 3.5 weeks for that trial seems like a long time.
Yeah. I think it was 2.5, but you know, I can't speak for the two prosecutors in that case. I empathize with where they were. I mean, listen, the two prosecutors that I tried this case against, I mean, I was a former colleague of theirs. Remember, I was in the Dade State Attorney's Office. I know these people. They're good lawyers. They're good people. They're good souls, as my grandmother used to say, right? And they really are. They're good people. But imagine the pressure on them. I mean, okay, we got O.J. Simpson. This is our chance to get him. They didn't get him in L.A. We're going to get him here. So, I wouldn't call it over trying, but I would call it, maybe a little overzealousness without treating it like a normal road rage case. So, I mean, what should occur in any prosecution of a celebrity is you ought to forget that you're dealing with a celebrity. And I know it's difficult because I know there's media. I know supervisors get involved. I know there's a lot of media critiquing, local newspaper critiquing going on. So don't get me wrong. I understand how difficult it is for a prosecutor, but the ones that are the prosecutors that are the most successful are the ones that forget about all of the visceral window dressing that's going on around the case. I mean, I want to digress. I want to just tell you a really quick story. So there was a local celebrity in Miami who owned a convenience store. And somebody broke into the store, and the owner of the store poured gasoline on the person and set them on fire. Now, I was not the first lawyer on the case. I was the second lawyer on the case. The first case was tried to a mistrial. There was a lot of media publicity in the case. And I end up trying the second case. And we were doing really well in the case until the closing argument came. And the prosecutor was an old colleague of mine. I'm not going to mention his name because he'd be embarrassed if I did it. But he gets up in his clothes and he says, "Mr. So-and-so is so fortunate to have Yale Galanter as his lawyer. He's not only fortunate, he's blessed. And Mr. Galanter has done such a great job for him." I start sinking down in my chair because I knew I was going to lose the case. I'll give you his first. His name is David. And I see him all the time. We joke about this. So he was a prosecutor in a very high profile case who wasn't concerned about what he said, wasn't concerned about the media, and didn't make it about what the media was saying, him against me. He let the jurors know that he and I were colleagues. We had mutual respect. He respected me as a lawyer. And then it just became about the facts. So when the jurors went back into the jury room, all they were thinking about was, my guy poured gasoline on someone and set him on fire. Why did he have to do that? And I ended up losing the case. And I'm telling you, the reason I lost that case was because of David's skill and knowing to keep the media out of it. I mean, it was just
great story. In fact, as you're telling that story, I had a smaller case as a defense lawyer, but I was making great headway in this case. It was one of the first cases here in Michigan that I think had gone to trial, where we were litigating the when the police get a blood draw, they used to have to, in a DUI case, they used to transport the accused to the hospital, and hospital staff would do it in the hospital. As things developed, politics, legislators, efficiency, whatever you want to call it, the law began to permit them to get a blood draw in an ambulance outside of the police station. And even in this case, they did it where they got this blood draw in the lockup area, which is, of course, filthy. So I made the entire case about, you know, this guy come in and he was putting a little, you know, pad down. There was nothing sterile about it. You wouldn't eat off the bench. You wouldn't eat off the floor. When you got out of the lockup area, everybody, of course, would, you know, if you went home, your spouse or loved one would torch the clothes. You know what I mean? And you'd have to get like a Karen Silkwood scratch down, you know? And like, it's in this environment that they took blood. And the case was really, I felt the needle was really moving in my favor until the prosecutor got up. And I don't know, we maybe had a day between the way the proofs ended and closing. And she got up and she did something very similar, which to this day I've given her credit for. She put me right out in front and said, "I just want to say this whole trial has been about this and this and this. And it's been about really great lawyering by, you know, Mr. Rockhine. Great, clever, genius lawyering, but it doesn't change the facts. I want to get back to the facts." And I sat there and I thought, like, this will be a quick verdict.
Yeah, exactly. Because
she did a great job of not making it about us, making it about the facts. Had she gone in there and maybe just tried to pound at me, I think the jury would have been left with, well, maybe Rockhine's onto something. It was brilliant. I thought it was really great. And to this day, I still tell her that whenever I see her. I still remember that great turnaround.
Right. And, you know, just to add to that point, you know, who your lawyer is matters. It really does. It's not always about the facts. Sometimes it is about the lawyering. And sometimes the lawyering can carry the day. I mean, it's really important. We are definitely not all fungible.
And we're not potted plants. I totally agree. Let me ask you this. So to you, and I know you're going to give me, what's the most important part of, generally speaking, a trial for you? You got voir dire, obviously opening, direct. We got cross if you're the defense, direct if you call any witnesses, closing. What's the most important part, if you can even identify the most important part?
No, I can, and I alluded to it. It's the minute you walk in the courthouse, even before you get into the courtroom, it's about establishing credibility with the juror. It's about being at the juror's level. And just to give you an example, when I was doing the OJ case in Las Vegas, there were a number of people who wanted to, you know, jump on the media bandwagon. And they were willing to pick me and my team up at the hotel in black stretch limousines, drive us to the courthouse. That is not the image I wanted on television. You know, I was getting out of a Jeep Cherokee that one of the secretaries at one of the local council lawyers was doing. And I would have people come up to me and say, yeah, we'll give you security, we'll give you car service, we'll do this. Not a shot, just not going to happen. And to the lawyers, the young lawyers who are listening, remember, you know, in most busy courthouses, jurors are not separated till they get to the jury room. And, you know, they meet a bailiff or, a jury marshal. So they see you. I mean, they see how you act.
Whoever is listening, this cannot be emphasized enough. Continue. I just want to really highlight this for lawyers that are trying to figure out how to win cases. You can lose a case in the parking lot.
Exactly. You can lose a case in the parking lot. You could lose a case if you're, we were always very conscientious about how we treated staff, bailiffs, you know, in the commissary, the wait staff, the cooks, the cleaners in the courthouse. You got to be aware of those things because people talk, and, you know, you're either a good person or you're a bad person. And, you know, you got to be very cognizant of the fact that, you know, as litigators, lawyers, criminal defense attorneys, you know, we're so blessed to have the skills and the profession that we have, but don't let it go to your head. And I mean, that's from the minute you get out of the parking lot. Don't get it.
I can't.
Like when I walk into a courthouse, you know, I'm always good morning to all the security people. They're hello, how are you, Mr. Galanter? I always say, please, you know, we've known each other for years. You can call me Yale. You know, that resonates.
You don't know who's, when you pull in, Yale, you're literally picking these thoughts out of my, well, not literally, but figuratively picking these thoughts out of my head. I have told young lawyers, like you, the person that you cut off in the parking lot to get the space closest to the courthouse door and you hustle in may be a prospective juror. And then when you get up there in front of the jury and you try to act all civil and polite and courteous, and they're sitting in the back going, that's the schmuck that like dashed in front of me and took the parking space or, you know, was speeding through or pushed me out of the elevator. They know you're a phony.
Yeah.
And it's going to, and they're going to share it. They're going to say, this is the guy that cut me off. I mean, that's the guy that cut me off a few moments ago.
Spot on. So that, to me, that's the most important part.
Brilliant.
You know,
absolutely brilliant. I can't stress it enough. I've seen, it's like, you know, those are unforced errors that lawyers make. It's like a lob comes to you and you sit there and you think, I'm going to win. And then you hit it into the net because you're just not thinking about that moment and how to, I've seen it so many times,
Yep.
All right. Let me ask you this. So your cross-examination style, even though the podcast is called Killer Cross-Examination, we make it about just the whole thing because I really want people, I think trial lawyers are still some of the, you know, we're the guys really out on the front. There's no Perry Mason. There's no Matlock. I mean, it's us. And we're great storytellers and we're blessed to be able to do it. But your cross-examination style, What's your preparation like for a particular witness? Walk me through that, if you would.
So there are a couple of things. One is whenever you're going to litigate a case, you need to know the facts and the law better than the judge, the prosecutors, and every other person in that courtroom. You know, a lot of people say to me, you know, Yale, you look so natural and you make it look so easy. Well, Neil, you and I both know it's not. You know, when you walk into the courtroom, you want to make it look like it's very normal and nonchalant and part of what you know, it's in your being. But, you know, I tell young lawyers all the time, preparation, preparation, preparation. And even when you think you're prepared, be even more prepared. So that's number one. You got to know everything about everything. The second thing is that not all cross-examinations are the same. So your style has to adjust depending on who you're cross-examining. You know, in the OJ trial in Las Vegas, I was cross-examining someone who we knew was a pimp. My cross-examination style with that individual was very different than if I'm cross-examining, you know, a female who has accused a client of mine of sexual battery. So one is more delicate, more taking the high road, more spoon feeding. The other is fire as many bullets as I can and, you know, throw as much mud against the wall as I can and see what sticks. So, you know, killer cross-examination, and that's a fabulous title for the podcast, and everybody knows what that means. But what it really means is effective cross-examination.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because effective is what we are all charged with being, and effective is different in every single case. And I think lawyers need to, you know, they need to think about that. I mean, they need to think about that before they get to court. It's not just about writing down the questions and the points you want to make. You know, you got to think about, okay, what am I trying to accomplish and how do I want to get there? And there are a number of ways to get there. So, you know, when I'm doing a cross-examination, ultimately, I think to myself, okay, I want the witness to say two or three things or five things or whatever it is. You know, it's not a just pound them, beat them up kind of session. It's you got to get certain information out of them. And then you got to figure out how to get there. I just did a motion to suppress in Aspen a week and a half ago. And I needed to get the lead officer to say basically one thing. And I cross-examined him for about 45 minutes just to get to that one little, you know, nugget of gold that I needed. And then I sat down. So I see lawyers go in with that, you know, they want to swing a big baseball bat all the time, beat them up, beat them up, beat them up with really no goal or plan. So cross-examination is not something that takes place in the courtroom. Cross-examination is something that takes place in the conference room of your office with your colleagues. Sometimes when we're cross-examining witnesses in high profile cases, we role play. You know, we have other lawyers do it to see how it comes out. You know, again, we have great power and great skill. You do not want to turn off jurors. Remember, you want to give them something to hang their hat on that will acquit your client and get you the result that you want.
You ever sat down at the end of a cross and thought to yourself, shit, like that did not go the way that I want, or I'd like a redo? Happens to me. I sit down and I'm very like, you know, damn it.
Listen, I'm very lucky that I've had some great critics in my career. I mean, one was my father and the other is my wife, who happened to have been my court reporter. Now, my wife was a court reporter long before I was a lawyer. So she knew what was going on in the courtroom.
She's seen good, bad.
Right. And, I would do crosses and, you know, walk out in the hall and say to her, how'd I do? And she'd shake her head and said, you didn't get there. And, you know, it takes a while to get really good at it. I mean, it just, it takes a while. And even today, it doesn't happen as much as it used to, but even today, you know, I am my own worst critic. I sit down and I go, oh, I forgot this, or I forgot that, or I should have done it another way. And I think that's why they call it the practice of law. I mean, it's a, you know, any lawyer who thinks that they are perfect probably shouldn't be doing what we do for a living. I mean, the only way we continue, I mean, and I'm hoping, and I don't know when my last case will be or when I'm ultimately going to retire, but whenever that moment comes, that last day, I want it to still be a learning experience. And, you know, I mean, I can't stress that enough. It's, you know, you constantly want to get better. So there's no such thing as a perfect 10. I mean, you could get close, but you always want to get better. You always want to do better. And we can always, you know, I mean, the reason we're lawyers is because, you know, we go through this gauntlet of law school and this obstacle course of a career that we all have. The idea is to make it more comfortable for ourselves, make it better for our clients, and always practice our skills and get better and better and better at it.
So, who's the best cross-examiner you've ever seen? I take this out of the, remember from the movie, The Right Stuff, where they ask Gordo Cooper at the end, who's the best pilot you ever saw? And he plays through and he goes through this long thing and he's about to say Chuck Yeager, but then he looks at the cameras and he goes, you're looking at him. So other than you, who's the best cross-examiner you ever saw?
I've seen a ton of really, really good cross-examiners. I mean, the list would go on and on and on and on.
Who stands out as you're thinking of that? Just one person.
I think Mark Garagos, very good cross-examiner. Great cross-examiner. You know, some of the more well-known names in the legal community, Johnny Cochran, great cross-examiner. Probably someone in our profession who just recently passed away, who was just fabulous in his heyday, was Lee Bailey. I mean, Lee was that, you know, most people don't know this about Lee because he's had such a high profile career. But Lee was one of those lawyers who, as I mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, you know, had that very folksy attitude. I mean, Lee would never walk in the courtroom with cowboy boots, and I'm not criticizing cowboy boots, but with spit shine shoes, an Armani suit, a pinky ring, and a Rolex watch. I mean, you know, it was a sport coat, gray slacks, and an improperly tied tie with him. But he was fabulous. And the reason he was fabulous was because, you know, he would always hit the nail on the head. He always had a plan. He always knew where he wanted to go. And sometimes, you know, like all of us, he couldn't always get there, but he knew how to regroup and how to recover from that. So very effective. And because he was so effective, you know, had a lot of really great successes in his career because he knew how to try a case at a level the jurors could relate to. So again, people think the crosses are really the most important part of the case. I've never thought that. I mean, it's definitely right up there, but again, your credibility, your ability to relate to a jury is so much more important. And, you know, we talked a little bit about what happens in the parking lot in the courthouse. It's also in the courtroom. You know, when the judge calls a recess for 10 or 15 minutes and the jurors are being taken out, you know, they see what you're doing. I mean, if you're talking to a colleague in a bad way or you're, you know, put your head down like this where you think you've blown a cross-examination, you know, you can't do that. I mean, you are literally, the camera is on you while 24/7 while you were in that courthouse, whether it's in the hallway, the parking lot, the courtroom. no matter what. Very, very important to relate to jurors. Listen, one other thing, Neil, it's not only relating to jurors, you got to get jurors to like you. I mean, you want jurors to go back into that jury room. And if they're going to find somebody guilty, you know, the no-win case, you want them to be hesitant because it's going to offend you. You want them to, and I mean this, it sounds silly, but, you know, if they like you, they're not going to want to rule against you. They're not going to want to find against you. And it works with a judge too. You got to, and the only way to do that is credibility, likability, you know, be open and forthright. I cannot tell you how many times in my opening statements, I say to jurors what the bad stuff is in my case, you know, because I got to take the wind out of the prosecutor's sails. And the last thing I want is jurors to go back into that jury room and say, you know, well, why didn't Galanter tell us about this? Or why didn't Galanter do this? So, you know, whatever the weak part of your case is, put it out there and then follow up with, but I'm going to explain to you why that is or why that occurred. I don't have the time now to do an opening statement, but listen very carefully as we go through that case. Because the last thing you want is jurors to go back into that jury room and either not like you or catch you in a white lie or a fib. Then you're done. You're just done.
I think that's, I have the same sort of philosophy. It's, you got to put that stuff out there, because if you think you're pulling one over on them and opening, I got news for you. As soon as they hear it, they're going to turn their heads and look at you and think that you just tried to pull one over on them. Yale, I could probably, your career and your insight is so valuable and so interesting to me. I could probably talk to you for 2 hours, but I know I have to let you get back to your life and your family. So where I'd like to leave off is, I think that you're so much information to offer to people, and you have so many, I'm sure, interesting cases. Could you give us some, just kind of, if someone wanted to learn more about you, your firm, or what you're doing, where would they go? Let's start with the website. If they wanted to find you, where would they find you on the web?
So the website is galanterlaw.com is our main website. And we have a number of ancillary websites, but it's GALANTERLAW.com. And that will give you a complete overview of the firm, the lawyers, the case history, the media. And if anybody ever wants to talk to me, all they have to do is call the main office number, which is 305-576-0244. You know, I'll be more than happy to call people back.
And we'll make sure that number is available to people when they listen to the podcast. Are you on social media? What social media? If you are, just tell us. And
So this is getting a little above my head, but yes, we have an IT social media person. We're on Instagram, we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook. And as far as I know, it's all under the Galanter Law moniker. Quite frankly, I don't follow it, but I know it's there because people say to me all the time, I saw this on Facebook or that, but that's, we have people that do that for us.
And last, I know you're licensed to practice law in 3 states. I think it's Florida, Colorado, and was
Washington,
it where
D.C.
Washington, D.C., which should be a state, but is not yet, but
yep.
Soon. But you have cases all over the country, and you certainly will talk to people who have cases in other parts of the country. And if it's not of interest or if your firm's not available, you, I presume, would try to hook them up with somebody that you think is the right fit. Is that right?
We do. Always. We always do. I mean, and again, is it, you know, most of the cases we don't take, because again, for me to travel, it's, you know, the case has to fit a certain criteria. But yeah, I mean, we don't shut anybody out. I mean, it doesn't matter to us whether, people can afford me or not. We really do try and help people. I mean, we refer people to the PD's office. And we give them phone numbers of lawyers that they could call just if the case isn't going the way they think. I mean, you know, as a profession, You know, I'm a big advocate of pro bono work, but it's even more than pro bono work. It's just that, you know, if somebody calls your office and they can't afford you, you know, instead of saying goodbye, you know, give them a number and say, listen, if you have, even if you can't afford us and you're using the PD's office or using another lawyer, give them a phone number. Always keep the doors open because you never know when someone's going to come back. You know, you just don't know. And I, you know, my mother and father taught me that. Never burn any bridges. Always keep the doors open. You just never know. I mean, you
That's
really
a great tip. Yeah, I can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast. It's been educational for me. It's also been just great to have this chance to take up an hour or so of your time and chat and kind of pick your brain. Again, our guest was Yale Galanter, who's one of the great trial lawyers in America. And I can't thank you enough. Thanks for being a
guest
on the show.
Thanks for having me, Neil. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.